more funny.
This is Audio Whiplash on the Tall Can Audio Network. Follow along on Twitter at Tall Can Audio or at facebook.com/tallcanaudio.
How's it going, everybody? Matt Robinson here with you, the Audio Whiplash Podcast. Only on the Tall Can Audio Podcast Network. Archives, everything you need to know, all at tallcanaudio.com. We're going to get to our guest here in just a second, Chris Stevenson from The Athletic Ottawa and the Ottawa Craft Beer Insider. We'll be with us once again. If you haven't had a chance, check out Tall Can Sports number 391. You can get that at tallcanaudio.com, as I mentioned a second ago, or anywhere you get podcasts, anywhere you're listening to this, you can find that one. Really interesting conversation with him, just about, especially if you're a Sens fan, you'd probably be interested in hearing his take on some of the young guys that they have coming along. Chris spends a bunch of time following, what's happening down on the farm in Belleville. So some good takes there. And we also spoke a little bit about Chris Phillips having his number retired by the Ottawa Senators and what goes into that and whether or not he had the type of career that warrants that type of honor here in the market and all kinds of stuff. So if you haven't had a chance to check that out, it's Tall Can Sports 391. Wherever you're hearing this, you'll be able to find that one. Those of you who've been with us for a while and caught a bunch of these shows with guests know that this sometimes happens, where essentially the show gets cut in half. So while Chris was here, we talked a great deal to him about his career, his journey, kind of how he got to where he is, how he ended up with The Athletic, why he thinks that type of publication or model is the way to go now in this industry. All kinds of great talk. Of course, we're going to talk some beer with him. For those who haven't heard, Chris Stevenson has started the Ottawa Craft Beer Insider. It's on YouTube. It's on your podcast app. You can find the first episode there with many more to come. You can just search Ottawa Craft Beer Insider in any of those places. You'll find it. So we, of course, had to talk a little craft beer with him while he was here. But I'm recording this intro essentially because it got split in half from the sports show. It would have ran almost 2 hours if we'd have left it as one episode. And really, the first half was more about, Chris and his journey. And we thought that was all really interesting. We didn't want to cut it out, but it maybe didn't fit perfectly as an episode of Tall Can Sports. So we decided to cut it in half, and we're going to give you that part of the conversation right now on Audio Whiplash. It's Chris Stevenson from The Athletic Ottawa and the Ottawa Craft Beer Insider joining Rob and myself on Audio Whiplash. We always start with a little craft beer talk. Yeah. And today we're from Bicycle Craft Brewing. Now, I don't think the more you talk about Velocipede, I think I've tried that.
Yep.
But I don't think I've had much out of this brewery. So today we're into, which one did you grab?
I've got the Happy Robot.
Yeah, and that's the one I'm getting into as well.
Which I have not had before.
Okay, so IPAs all around here.
I feel like
here.
I broke protocol here.
Okay.
I even went on the air and I'm totally good.
I have the Orchid.
Okay.
Which, is slightly different, I believe. It's kind of smooth, really. It doesn't have that sort of hoppy bite to it.
This got a little bit of a bite. I'm curious your take.
Impression
first
is
pull.
a little bit lighter on the tongue than typically most IPAs would be.
Okay.
Some hops at the beginning.
Yeah.
And then transitions into, I said I wasn't going to read the label. I felt like it was pineapple, and it does say pineapple on here and mango.
Yeah.
And typically I don't lean towards the more citrusy type IPAs.
Right.
I like them very much hop forward, but I actually enjoyed the finish on this one. So I'm giving Happy Robot a thumbs up right now.
Right on.
Okay. And I'm with you in terms of usually, especially I like mine to be a little hazy.
Yep.
And I like that sort of aroma of citrus that doesn't always play out in a big aroma. I mean, in a big fruity sort of flavor, but this is sort of smoother than I would normally anticipate with a a Northeastern style IPA.
Yep. Well, you're into the orchid, right? And so
Yes, exactly. I will check that out.
Yep. After. As we move along here. You can tell already Chris knows his beer. He's talking pretty educatedly. We will get to that a little bit. But before we do anything else, and we will come back around to the beer, why don't we talk, just plug your show a little bit. Yeah, I know you're starting up a bit. You got the Ottawa Craft Beer.
Yeah, we've done one episode, and Lon Liddell from Big Rig, and thought the first one should have a little bit of a news hook to it. And of course, with Big Rig getting sold mm-hmm. to Foodtastic in Quebec, Lon was good enough to give us an hour or so and just talk about the future of Big Rig and what this sale means for the future of Big Rig, because I think, you know, pretty quickly they established themselves a nice niche here in Ottawa, and are really trying to expand their footprint now. I think they've got some great beers which are going to be a hit. I know they're looking at expanding to Toronto with a couple of the Big Rig stores, and I think doing my research, the Foodtastic chain, which is based in Quebec, and anybody who goes to Montreal, and I believe there's one in Gatineau, but if you're looking for a good hamburger place, they have a place called Belle Le Bouffe, which is on
right on Guy,
on St. Catherine Street. Yeah, right by Guy. Yeah. And that's become one of my go-to places when I'm looking for an off-day meal in Montreal if I'm there covering the Canadians. So that's part of the chain there. And I think what they're looking to do is a little bit of vertical integration by acquiring Big Rig. They're going to have Big Rig brew beers for them now for all their 88 stores that they've got now with plans to expand.
Yeah.
So, you know, you'll be able to go in there and have Big Rig brews in Belle Le Bouffe and all the other stores that they've got.
We recommend, I listened to it, I watched it actually on YouTube.
Yeah, yeah.
I recommend the listener go and check it out. Informative, I think, and I don't want to spoil everything that was in it.
Yeah, yeah. No, go ahead.
It was the, because I at times, I've the A-Bomb I've drank a lot.
Yep.
The Release the Hounds has been kind of a go-to. I like the Bongo Rattler. To me, I always like to finish a show a little lower alcohol.
Yep.
So I've been a big supporter of Big Rig. And so I was interested in hearing what was going to happen,
yep,
if it was going to change, right? And so what Lon was saying was, yeah, they're not really so interested in that. They're kind of more interested in letting him continue to to do what's made him successful, which was key for me.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's, and I kind of put it to him that way in the show, is that, you know, a lot of people, I think you have a favorite product or whatever that's on a smaller scale, they get bought by somebody bigger, and the next thing you know, the bigger company that's taken over is only concerned with profit margins and everything else, and you see the quality decline, right? Because now they're trying to cut, now they're trying to maximize their profit, and the things that the store or the company or the brewer that you enjoyed, you know, now it's not quite the same.
Well, so, that cool factor's gone a little, right? Yeah. Like we talked quite a bit when Mill Street.
I was just going to say, we're looking at you, Mill Street.
Yeah, and you kind of go, you know, it's just not quite the same as it once was. So, so where can people find the show? What should they search for? How can people check it out?
Search for Ottawa Craft Beer Insider, and you'll find it. And we've lined up our next couple of shows. I think we'll be recording them in the next week or so. And it's not going to be so much about, you know, sampling and breaking down beer. Like over my career, what I've always enjoyed the most about being a journalist is really telling people stories. So
right.
It's going to be much more about, you know, with Lon, like I thought that was interesting with him getting into, you know, his background, the son of a brewer and growing up in Vancouver, really on that first wave of when West Coast craft brewing was really taking off and kind of working his way up from sweeping the floors to learning how to be a brewer. So for me, that's, you know, that's what you can look for in this show, is going to be more the stories of the people behind the brands. And, you know, it's been my experience, you know, I kind of got into craft beer, I guess, probably in the mid-90s through one of my buddies who owned the Clock Tower.
Oh, yeah.
For sure.
John there, who got it started in 96. So that's really kind of where my roots. And that was the thing that I always enjoyed about the beer was, you know, number one, when you go the craft route, And this is what I tell my friends who just feel like, you know, the whole craft beer thing's too hard to get into.
Right.
A bit of a beer snob.
I don't even know where to start, and I just like to have my Budweiser or my Coors Light or whatever, my Budweiser. And I'm like, that's fine. Mm-hmm. But whatever you enjoy about a Budweiser, think about it being multiplied by five, because it's just going to be fresher and more flavorful. If you just want to slip into maybe like a, you know, a nice Pilsner or something to start with.
Yeah.
Well, and I think that's been a little bit of an issue, is I think a lot of people look at craft beer and they regard it as being kind of hipster and too cool for them,
yep,
you know?
Yep.
But I would be the farthest thing from a hipster. and for me, it's just, it's such a wonderful journey. When I travel, I love going to local bars and just having somebody behind, hopefully you're going to have a server that's that knows their stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I want to try something local. So, you know, you guys, I've told you guys I'm into the IPAs, and that's all, you know, if they've got two or three IPAs to try all three of them. You never know when you're going to take that sip and you're just going to be like, wow, this one's not now on my list of go-tos,
right, yeah.
You know?
Well, and have you spoken to Andy over at the Need a Beer Company? As we've had him on a few times, yep. And they did that the Advent calendar.
Yeah, what a great idea!
It was really cool,
we both had it this year, and it was
And so you get
a great idea
from all over the province this year. Last year it was mainly from the Ottawa area, but it's expanding out, and you get every day something a little different to try, right? And it's right there in your fridge.
And you know what? Some of them you're going to take two sips, and you're just going to be like, nope.
Absolutely.
Not for me. You either pass it over to somebody who's going to appreciate it, or it might get drunk. But again, like I said, when you either, you know, take the flip the top off a bottle or crack a can, you never know when you're going to have that first sip and then that swallow and the aftertaste and be like, yeah, that's
right in my wheelhouse.
That's one I can add to my list.
Well, and the thing is too, is the older I get and you're not so concerned about maybe taking down a dozen Wildcat Strong, right? You've sort of put that in the rearview mirror, and people say, well, it's $4 a can. Yeah. And I'm saying, but it's as all the things you've outlined, and it's also local for the most part. Yeah. You're supporting a local business who's putting their stake in the ground, saying, this is what I want to do, and that needs to be supported.
Yeah. And that's a good point too, because, you know, part of telling the local stories here is there's a bit of a sensibility or mentality about the craft beer business here too, that they're interested in their communities and they're interested in putting back as well. So, you know, for me, that's another reason to support them, besides the fact that the beer's great.
Yeah,
is for most in most cases. And again, we're going back and talking about the smaller scale. You know, they do have deep roots in our community, and they are interested in putting back community, which for me is just another reason to support them.
Well, and it's fun, right? A lot of the time there's different stories behind it you know, we had, like I said, Andy Nita in here, and he talked about their new lager, which they'd never had before. And that he told us the story behind it being named after his father and everything that went into that.
I love those stories.
There's one that came from the calendar that was, it said right on the can that this is, you know, in college, the brewer had played in punk bands. And he said, I always wanted to try and create like a British punk rock style IPA. And he goes, I don't know what that means, but I wanted to do it.
Yeah.
And so you kind of drank it and you go, all right, I kind of get that. It's a little grittier than a normal IPA. And so it's just kind of fun, right? And instead of just going in, grabbing your 24 Bud or Blue or Canadian or whatever it's going to be. And, you know, you get a little something extra out of it. So
I can hear a little bit of Johnny Rotten as I take
exactly,
a sip of this.
Exactly. Yeah.
As long as you can't taste a little Johnny Rotten, you're totally good.
So it's the Ottawa Craft Beer Insider. It's on YouTube and it's wherever you get your podcast. Make sure you check that out.
Thanks.
I want to start kind of with your journey and, you know, how you kind of get started, how you find yourself getting into journalism, sports journalism specifically. Take us back. Where does that start for you?
You know, I think with a lot of us, it starts with just being a sports fan as a kid. Growing up in Montreal was a huge Canadiens and Expos and Alouettes fan.
Right.
And, you know, I guess you get to a point where, you know, you start thinking about what am I going to do?
Probably
for
not
going to
make
yeah,
it in
living.
The majors.
Yeah.
Maybe I could write about the majors.
Yeah. And, you know, so, you know, one of the neat things that I had happened to me in my life is growing up in Montreal, I used to deliver the Montreal Star.
Oh yeah,
had a paper route when those existed, and it was actually kids that delivered the paper.
Right.
And Red Fisher used to cover the Canadians for the Star, and then when the Star folded, he moved over and started writing for the Montreal Gazette. Kind of looked at you know what Red Fisher did, and thought you know what he did and how he helped me to experience the Montreal Canadiens, I thought was really cool. So it kind of started working into the back of my mind that maybe sports writing would be something that I'd pursue. So whenever I got the chance to take English courses or writing courses for options in high school or whatever, I went that way. So a little bit of a sidetrack because
that's what we do here.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wasn't, there'd be lots of tangents.
Yeah, sure.
So I wasn't sure what I was going to do when finished high school. I went and took, we have CGEP in Quebec, which is kind of junior college between high school and university, and was into, I was a decent student. I was into maths and sciences in CGEP. And I was just like, you know, this isn't really, not really doing it for me. And I can't remember, a friend of mine told me about Carleton University and the journalism program. So I applied to, I was working in a factory. I dropped out of school, was working in a, took a job at a, in a factory where I'd been working during the summers for, since I was 15 or 16 years old, I think. Just, you know, basically, it was a company that made screen door closers, like storm door closers.
Okay.
And, would work on the assembly line, you know, basically piling up the parts for the ladies that worked on the assembly line as they assembled these door closers as they went by. And I did that for 4 or 5 summers and then worked for there for a year to save up money to be able to go to school.
Right.
And then I applied to Carleton to the journalism program and got a polite no. I was told
we appreciate your interest in
yes,
our program.
Yes, exactly. Good luck with your future endeavors. Yeah. So I basically wrote back and said, well, what do I need to do to be able to get in? And they said, well, if you, you know, go to CGEP and you can get a, whatever it was, a B+ average, we'd consider letting you into mass communications.
Hmm.
So I did that. I worked at a factory during the day, went to school at night, got my grades, applied to Carleton, got into the mass communications program. And did that. And then again, I was like, well, how can I get over to the journalism program? And they were like, well, if you have an A- average your first year in mass comm, you can get in. So
it's tough sledding.
Yeah. Anyway, got the grades. So I get to residence. I move into residence for my second year. Thought I had the grades. And I got a letter saying, sorry, you know, we only take whatever it was at that time, 60 new students in J school each year. And I didn't make it. And then I run into a friend of mine on the floor. Same deal. He was in mass comm the year before. We got the same grades. He got in.
Oh, really?
I'm like, how'd you get in? It's like, oh. When I got my letter saying that I couldn't get into second year, my dad called our MP.
Oh.
I'm like, oh, that's how the world works.
Seriously. Hello.
Yes. One of the first big life lessons at university, right?
Leverage.
Not your marks, but who you know.
Yeah.
Anyway, I went over to one of the profs and said, this doesn't seem like right to me, but here are my grades. My buddy had the same grades. Yeah. He's in, I'm not. He told me the story how. And I was basically told then, you're in second year journalism now.
Yeah,
and go
we'll
over,
get you in there.
Go over to registration now, drop all these courses and take these courses. So there you go. A little bit of serendipity got me that chance meeting in the hallway in second Russell residence at Carleton got me, I guess, on the path where I wind up.
Residence life is important.
Today. Okay, and, yes. And the guy you met? What happened to him?
Greg, he's working in London. I just started following him on Twitter.
Like, for the Free Press?
Still working, yeah.
Okay, look at that. Yeah. All right, so
both of us kind of...
You didn't bump him. I didn't
knock him out of his spot. Yeah.
Greg, you're in.
Bad news,
Don't
Greg.
Tell that story, Greg, ever again.
But yeah, so went to Carleton and got offered a job. I got a history of dropping out. Just occurred to me. But okay. I got offered a job in my third year at Carleton, so dropped out and took the newspaper job.
Where was that?
It was at a broadsheet weekly called Ottawa Review, R-E-V-U-E.
Sure.
Of course.
And it had been a small kind of like arts paper, I think it was, and they had decided to expand it into more like a community type paper, and they wanted to do sports. So I interviewed for the job and got it. It was a one-man operation, but probably the best experience for a young journalist going, because I wrote about 20 stories a week.
And you're doing everything.
If you dare, what year roughly is this?
That would have been 83.
Okay.
So worked there for a year, and it was bought. That paper was bought by the Sunday Herald. I don't know if you guys remember the Sunday Herald, but the Sunday Herald was like a... back in those days, there was only the Citizen in town. The Journal had folded just after I got here in 79. So there was just the Citizen in town. They didn't publish on Sundays. So Lowell Green, who the broadcaster other partners, started this Sunday Herald, which was basically a daily paper one day a week on Sundays. So it had all the sports news from Saturday, and we had a really good lineup of contributing columnists. So we went big on Montreal and Toronto sports. It had a huge sports section.
Right.
And it was big on the NFL during the NFL season. But we had, you know, Brody Snyder, who was a legendary guy who covered the Expos, did a weekly Expos column for us. And Glenn Cole, who had covered the Habs for a long time for the Gazette and other papers in Montreal, you know, did Habs pieces for us. So it was, you know, as a sports fan, I was a fan of the paper before I went to work there.
Right.
And so worked at the Sunday Herald, and then the Toronto Sun bought the Herald, and that was the beginning of the Ottawa Sun.
Okay,
so that was kind of the progression. So I just kind of went like along for the ride. The Review got bought by the Herald, went to work for the Herald.
Yeah,
Herald got bought by the Sun, and went to work for.
Just keep moving up.
And went to work for the Sun. Yeah.
So
and
in those sort of early days at the Herald, at the Sun, there's no NHL team here yet. What are you doing day to day? What are you kind of covering in this area?
Obviously, I was doing that was summer of 1988 when the Sun bought the Herald, and they for a little while for that summer they published it just as a Sunday paper. So it was the Ottawa Sunday Sun,
right?
With the plan to go daily, and then in November of 88 they went daily. So what did I do? Well, I remember George Gross, who was the sports editor at the Toronto Sun, the Baron as they used to call him. He used to call all of us Keto. Hey, Keto. Anyway, he comes by my desk one day and he's like, Keto, you and I need to go out for lunch. And I'm like, oh boy, here it comes. He's going to tell me that they're bringing some people in from Toronto and Stevenson's looking for a job. But anyway, we went out and he said, you know, we're going to have a lot of pages to fill in this paper and we don't really have a lot of sports going on here in Ottawa. How would you feel about going and covering the Montreal Canadiens for us?
Wow. Nah, not interested.
I was like, I don't know. Are you going to give me a raise too? But
went from thinking I was losing my job to seeing if I can get a raise and a better gig out of this.
No, I didn't ask for the raise. Yeah, right. I was just very
it's a good story though.
I was gobsmacked, I guess would be a pretty good word. So so that year 88-89, the Montreal Canadiens under Pat Burns went to the Stanley Cup final. Lost to the Flames. I did every game, home and away.
Wow.
So if you want to talk about a great learning experience to have that opportunity. Yeah. And then the first road trip that we go on, and back in those days, most of the beat writers traveled with the team.
Mm-hmm.
So, you would be on the bus going to the airport. You'd be on the charter to travel with the team. And... wouldn't you know? I don't know if they were just testing me or what, but Red Fisher, you know, again, a guy who was probably responsible for me even having an interest in being a sports writer, was, you know, a grumpy, let's face it, a grumpy old curmudgeon.
Yeah.
And he was legendary for not talking to rookies.
Okay.
So if you were a rookie on the Habs, Red was not going to talk to you for your your first season. That was the kind of stature that he had.
Did he have the same rule for other
Montreal?
Journalists?
Well, I was going to find out because, of course, on the charter, they sit me beside Red Fisher. And that was very much a situation where I was just like, keep my mouth shut.
Right.
Go yes, about my
yes,
business.
Mr. Fisher.
If
no,
he
Mr.
speaks
Fisher.
To me, exactly. Yes. If he speaks to me, great, whatever. So, yeah, I remember sitting beside Red, and he introduced himself and asked me about my background and what was happening in Ottawa, told me a story that he was in Ottawa when he found out that the Star was going to be closing because the Star had a labor dispute, and I guess they just decided rather than settle the labor dispute, they would just close the paper.
Yeah.
And the Canadians were in Ottawa to play an exhibition game at the Civic Center. That's how Red found out that the Star was the Star was closing. So at least for me, that started one of my most cherished, I guess, professional relationships that I had, because then over the years, I spent a lot of time covering the Canadians over my time with the Sun and the other places that I've worked since.
Yeah.
But it was always a very much a sense of privilege that I felt, because I was allowed to sit at Red's table for the pregame meals.
Yeah,
at first the Forum, and then later at the Molson Center, which became the Bell Center.
Yeah.
I've heard
many writers talk about the table.
Having that chance for years and years to have a seat, and many a night, other people would have all left, and it would just be me and Red, he would tell all kinds of great stories about his early days with the Habs, and you can read most of them in his book. But that was, you know, really one of the great highlights of my professional career was being able to listen to Red firsthand tell those stories. You know, as a kid growing up in Montreal, the man was a legend.
Yeah, as big a name as there is in hockey writing in Canada, for sure. So you are covering the Habs for the Sun as it becomes a daily. You know, I'll let you kind of jump ahead as much or as little as you think is necessary. Where do you find yourself? How long is that kind of I've seen in your bio, you got to cover a couple Olympics as we went here. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, as far as the hockey stuff goes, I mean, so I do the Habs for 88, for 88, 89. And right around that time, I remember, so I did a lot of golf. So I pretty much did hockey in the wintertime and some golf stuff in the summertime. And I was at the Canadian Open in, I guess it must have been the summer of 88. And Doug Smith was our associate sports editor. Jane O'Hara was the first sports editor at the Sun.
All right.
And I get a phone call, no cell phones back then. I get a phone call in the media room at Glen Abbey, covering the Canadian Open, and it's Doug Smith, who's the associate sports editor, and he's like, you ever heard of a company called Terrace Investments? And I'm like, who?
Yes.
He's like, well, they're bidding for an NHL expansion franchise for Ottawa. And yeah, that's exactly what it was, long silence.
Yeah.
I'm like, okay. He's like, can you...
We'll never beat Hamilton.
I'm like, you know, you're in Toronto, but can you... can you see what you can dig up?
Right.
Yeah. So, you know, that leads to finding the names Randy Sexton and Cyril Leader and Bruce Firestone. So I continued to cover the Canadians on a regular basis, but then this side deal was covering the whole expansion bid for the Senators. And it's incredible now because there's a lot of people, you know, we're getting to... what the franchise has been around for?
You're coming up on 30, yeah, a couple more years, it'll be 30 years.
To 30 years. So there are people now who are huge fans of this team who were not born when all this was happening. So I don't know if any of those people who are big Senators fans now appreciate the amount of skepticism there was around this whole idea that one, who are these guys?
Yeah.
you know, a bunch of real estate guys, really. That's what Terrace Investments was. And two, they're never going to give a team
right
to Ottawa, as you said. How do you beat out Hamilton? How do you beat out Houston?
Right.
You know, how do you beat out, you know, even at that time there was talk of another team for Southern California.
Well, so you're covering this process all the way through, by the sounds of it. Is it like the day that the announcement is made that you're going, all right, this is going to happen? Like, is this always as far-fetched as it? I just recently read Bruce Firestone's book.
Yeah.
And it was a long shot from minute one.
Yeah.
Was there ever a point where you said, all right, maybe they're going to get this done? Or did it catch you as off guard as everybody else?
I thought, you know, you hear, you're trying to talk to as many people as you can, right? So yeah. In 1990, when they were getting ready to actually award the franchises, and at that time, the indications were at those meetings in Palm Beach, Florida, was that they were not going to award the franchises at that Board of Governors meeting in December, that they were going to start the process of interviewing all the potential candidates. And I want to say that there was like about eight. I've got a book out on the Senators, and I went into a lot of detail about all those early days.
100, the title?
Yeah. 100 things Senators fans should know and do before they die.
Yeah. So the feeling at the beginning of the week was that this was just going to be, you know, part of the interview process, and that franchises weren't going to be awarded. And then I think as they started getting people into the room and talking to them, and didn't get some of the answers that they wanted from, for instance, you know, Ron Joyce with the Tim Hortons folks who were fronting Hamilton, told them that they weren't really happy with like the payment schedule for the franchise fee. And, you know, that's one of the things we would like to change. We don't want to give you two payments of $25 million. We would like to just break it up into maybe a bunch of $5 million payments over a longer term. And it was and the attitude of the NHL at that point, the Board of Governors, was basically our terms are nothing.
Right.
So I think the best strategy that the folks at Terrace Investments has was, even though they might not have been completely truthful answers at the time, when they said, you know, will you pay $50 million US for a franchise? They said yes, even though they didn't have any money.
Yeah, yeah. But we'll find
we've,
it.
We've all been there.
Yeah.
Will you build, you know, an 18,000 seat arena?
Yeah.
Yes, even though we don't have a plan.
Yeah.
So it was
gonna build
basically
it
just
to Kingston.
answer yes to every question, and we'll worry about
and figure it out.
We'll worry about figuring it out later.
Yeah.
So yeah, it became a little bit of a surprise that later on in the week. We got up in the morning thinking it was going to be just another day. And in talking to some of the Senators people, they're like, well, we've been called to an emergency meeting this morning. And and they told us that we need to be there. So maybe something is happening. And you know, they tell the story way better than I do. But, you know, basically being led through the back alleys and past the dumpsters and the steaming stuff in the kitchen and everything else.
Yeah, exactly.
In the back of the Breakers Hotel, to be led into this room with Phil Esposito.
Which even sounds seedy,
doesn't
it?
Yes. And it's funny. It's funny because they see Phil Esposito and think, oh, we're out.
Yeah.
Tampa's in.
Phil sees them and it's like, yes, we're getting a franchise. This is the winner's room.
Yeah.
But the Ottawa guys walk in and we're like, oh. They're like the guys in Animal House there when they walk in and they lead them over to the little table. Yeah. They don't want them on the couch, no. So, you know, they wind up being granted the franchise and here we are today.
Yeah.
Man. And it's interesting that the NHL was there for you so early in your career, through the Habs thing, into the Senators bidding process and through. But junior hockey must have been here in town.
Yeah, I had an opportunity to do a lot of junior hockey, and I count that as one of the you don't realize it at the time. But the relationships that you were making back then, like on a day-to-day basis, and I think back now, like, you know, so trying to think of guys like, you know, Gary Roberts, who I covered with the 67s,
love
who ended up covering him through his whole career. And he became, yeah, you know, as I said in the book, he became like the white whale for the Ottawa Senators. They kept chasing him and trying to get him. And, you know, urban legend is that's why John Muckler lost his job, was because he didn't make the trade to get get Gary Roberts when Roberts went to the Florida Panthers.
From the Pens to the Florida Panthers.
Yeah. So I think about all those guys that I met covering junior hockey who went on to the NHL, and I already had relationships with them when they were in the NHL, which obviously is very helpful.
Yeah.
You know, young coaches and executives in the OHL who went on to work in the NHL and agents that you dealt with. Like, I don't know if a lot of young journalists realize that while you might look down on something and say, well, it's only junior hockey, even if it's the junior B team in your town, that the relationships that you make at that stage of your young career, exactly.
Yeah.
And really, that's what this business is all about, is relationships. You know,
contacts.
Learning who has got good information, developing relationships where there's a mutual respect and trust. Because let's face it, there's times when people you're dealing with, whether it's general managers or agents, they've got their own agendas. Maybe a GM is trying to, you know, create a bit of a trade market for one of his players. Maybe an agent's trying to get one of his guys a new deal. So,
when might you be being used?
It's a symbiotic relationship.
Right.
And it all comes down to exchanges of information. And the trust factor is there through the relationships and the respect that's developed, like I said, from a lot of times in those very early years of your career. I bet if you talk to you know, guys like Bob McKenzie and Elliot and all those guys, you know, Bob covered junior hockey up in the Sioux and you know, that's really where you
ended up at the Hockey News after that.
You
just build this Rolodex, right?
That's exactly it.
Yeah.
And you don't know it, but you and I go way back.
Ooh.
This is actually the first time we've ever met. But I'm thinking I come from Peterborough. I went to high school in Peterborough. That's where I grew up.
You managed to escape.
wait on it. Love the junior hockey. Pete's on a Thursday night. So I came back home. My family's from here originally too. So I came back to go to Carleton for university.
Yep.
And the OHL has seen fit to give Peterborough the 95 Memorial Cup.
Yeah.
I think it was 95.
Yep.
And you had written an article saying, you know,
what a bad decision.
The Mem Cup has passed by, you know, they needed a big, and so I thought, I'm outraged by this.
I took a pen,
and for listeners out there, in those days,
couldn't just tweet.
Yeah, there was no tweeting. There was no text messaging. There was no emailing. I had to actually take up paper and pen and tell this Chris Stevenson guy that this is the lifeblood. You can't pass by the Peterboroughs, the Brandons, and the Chicoutimis. But anyways, yeah. So we corresponded. Man, you're talking.
I think there might have even been a beer reference in that piece, because I think I said something along the lines of giving the Memorial Cup to Peterborough was like picking a glass of water over a nice cold beer.
See, incensed. Incensed I was, I tell you.
And as an Oshawa guy, I'm with you. Screw Peterborough.
And I think there was something, there was something else, because Barry Campbell, who covered junior hockey for years with the Sun, and Barry and I ended up the lockout year 2005, we spent 10 days together in London at the 2005 Memorial Cup.
That's the Sidney Crosby one?
Yeah, Sidney Crosby and the Knights.
I think of that as the Danny Savret Memorial Cup.
Mark Mathot. I think it's also Mark Mathot one. Sure. Yep.
Corey Perry. All those. Robbie Shrimp.
I can remember. And I think another thing I made a reference to was like, wow, there's not much things more special in the springtime than like the canal in Ottawa.
Yeah.
But Peterborough's got the lift lock.
Yeah. Yeah.
So every time Barry and I would go by and we'd see a sign for the Peterborough lift lock, Barry would be like, ooh, the lift lock. Yeah.
should we stop and bask in the glow of the lift lock?
So
yes.
I get to Peterborough for the Memorial Cup. I go.
Won by Granby, I do believe.
Yeah. So I go to the, and they had like outside the rink.
The Mem Center?
That little band box.
Yes. Of the rink. Loved it.
They've got a trailer outside for the accreditation. So anyway, I walk into the trailer and...
lots of trailers in Peterborough. Yeah.
They're
good so, listener.
Walk in and the young lady there is like, can I get your name and affiliation, please? And I was like, Chris Stevenson from the Ottawa Sun. She got a bigger part?
No.
Like Chris Stevenson from the Ottawa Sun. And down at the end of the trailer is this big cop. Yep. A big cop. And he's standing there at the end of the table. Anyway, she gets my accreditation already and gives it to me. And now I got to walk, you know, down the rest of the line of tables to the exit door at the end where the cop is standing. So he's like standing in front of the door. And I get there.
Small town justice. I'm like, we're going to fold here, ladies and gentlemen.
I'm waiting for him like to move so I can get out. And he like looks down at me and he says, I never thought you'd show your face. I'm like, well, I'm here. He's like, I respect you for it. I'm like, thank you. And that accreditation, I can't remember the name of the bar. What were the bars then? There was like Copperfields
or Battlefields on a Saturday night, right? same thing. Spill out into the Canadian Tire parking lot.
I don't know if it was that one or not.
Falstaff's next to it.
My accreditation wound up hanging from the antlers of a deer or something behind a bar.
Yes. See, there you go.
That was my parting
local legend.
My parting gift to Peterborough.
Here
after
it is,
drinking there for 10 days. I was like, here.
You backwoods hillbillies, take this.
Yeah.
Loved my time there.
There
you go. So clearly, you don't remember that story at all.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah,
it's clearly burned burned right into you.
Yeah.
So the Sens are here. You're working for the Sun. That's going to be your gig for quite a while. Which Olympics do you cover? What's your gig there?
Like, yeah, I did. What did I do? I did Calgary in 88 the first one.
The home games. Nice.
Yep. And that was basically because of Liz Manley. She was competing.
Local girl?
That was still with like the Sunday Herald, the once a week paper, which I give them a lot of credit.
How do you get out there
for springing for me to go out and cover?
It's Liz Katarina Vitt, right?
And that's, and she won the silver. I remember the headline on the paper was Silver Bell or whatever. And great tabloid headline.
Yes.
So I did Calgary in 88. I did. How did they go? Atlanta in 96. Nope. Atlanta in 96 because we had the rower.
Sydney Allison 2000. Korn.
Yep. I did Sydney in 2000. Salt Lake 2002.
Athens 04.
No, I didn't.
Torino 2006.
Nope. And then I did
Beijing 8.
I did Vancouver 2010. I did London 2012. Oh, wow. I did Sochi 2014.
Okay.
So I think I did eight altogether.
That's.
And then I guess as of 2010, I was kind of like the national hockey guy at that point. So
right.
I did just hockey 2010, men's and women's.
That's the place to do it.
Yeah, honestly, just hockey in Sochi in 2014. And London, I did a little bit of everything. Most of the Summer Olympics I went to, I wound up being the rowing guy. I don't know why, but I think once you get a little bit of an area, expertise, a little bit of expertise, and then you get to know some of the people, which always helps. And I didn't mind the rowing gig.
Yeah,
it does mean getting up like at 4:30 in the morning because they put the boats in the water like at 8:30. And typically the rowing venues were always an hour or an hour and a half away from, obviously a large metropolitan.
Had to find some semi-clean water source.
Yep.
So beyond Vancouver 2010, which of course are home games, and you mentioned you did 88 as well, is that a gig that a writer is vying for? Is there a little extra something to that? Or, you know, are there certain ones where you're like, I'd be fine to stay home?
It's like Mike Farber, who's another guy that I've always admired. And again, I feel like it's been
Gazette,
a privilege,
right?
Of
Montreal,
working. Yeah. And then Sports Illustrated. Yeah. It, another thing that I feel like has been a privilege of doing what I do is getting to know guys like Michael Farber, who you really look up to and admire the way that they go about their craft.
Right.
I remember Mike telling me at an Olympics one time about how the Olympics represented the full circle of a journalist's life. He's like, you start off covering high school volleyball and soccer and all the things that nobody really cares about. And then when you've made it, you go back to covering
Olympic soccer
and volleyball.
Exactly.
And he's kind of like the big circle of journalism.
You haven't paid attention to it since then,
no,
except for an Olympic year.
No, but all those things, though, because, like I said, in the summer I would wind up doing some rowing. I would always kind of have my one eye whenever the World Rowing Championships were on or whatever, just to kind of store some things in the back of my mind in terms of what might be interesting stories. And people would say to me, like, well, what do you know about rowing? And I'm like, does it matter? All I know is there's 8 people in the women's heavy 8, and there's 8 stories in there.
Right. I just need to know more than the people I'm writing for.
All I need to know is their name. Everybody's got a story, and for me, I kind of look at it as, you know, the regular Canadian fans probably got the same attitude. They don't know about the technicalities of rowing, and if you can impart a little bit of knowledge or expertise and help them expand their knowledge of the sport, that's great. But I think for the most part, you know, Canadians are interested in the story of these
Canadian
magnificent
athlete,
Canadian athletes.
Every
and how
4 years,
got to
we all
be
become
there.
Diving
right.
experts.
Yeah, exactly.
And then, but those are the best stories in the games, right? You get the deep dive into somebody who is a trampoliner or you know, whatever those things are. Those sorts of things.
Rosie McLennan.
Yeah, you know nothing about her.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Until she does it.
And then, it's a household name.
And there's always, you know, the other thing. It's in that movie Richard Jewell is out right now, and I covered those Olympics in Atlanta in 96, and that actually, at that time, relatively young in my career, I was kind of the low man on the totem pole of the team that the Sun Chain would send to the Olympics, because ahead of me there'd be the Terry Jones and the Steve Simmons and all those, the veteran guys. Who would kind of get they'd be fighting over the, you know, who was going to get to go and cover the next gold medal. And then I kind of got whatever was left over. But I think a thing that really helped me in my career in 96 was I kind of became the person that had to cover off the news of the bombing in Atlanta. So, I think that kind of got me a little bit of a reputation as a guy who could be trusted to kind of be handed a relatively big story and at least get the bare bones of it to make it work. You go into all those Olympic games with a plan, right? And there's always something that goes incredibly awry, either good or bad.
Yeah.
And like we would have these meetings to cover the Olympics and people would be in there with these huge spreadsheets and the whole schedule and the Canadians that are favored and which events should we prioritize in terms of covering them. And then Ross Begliati would fail a doping and everything would go out the window for like the next week.
It's
and it's great to have a plan, but that was the thing I loved about covering those big events was you just knew at
the
some
chaos.
Point there was
the unpredictability
be some
of
kind of crazy thing that would happen. And then everybody would just be scrambling, which for me was like the thrill of the chase.
Sure.
Right.
Well, so I'm curious, at this point, you know, you've done the Olympics, you've done the NHL, you've been all over the place. You've done the Sun, I believe you do the NHL.com gig.
The Sun and I had a parting of the ways. I was a national hockey writer, and we had a national bureau, which everybody knows the direction the newspaper business has been going in, and they decided to close down the national bureau.
So what year would that be roughly?
2014.
So you moved to the NHL.com in 2014.
Yeah, and I consider myself, again, very, very fortunate that as soon as the Sun and I parted ways, that day – you know, talking talking to NHL.com, called and said, hey, if you're available, we'd love to have you come and
build yourself
for
enough
us.
Of a reputation.
So I just went, I went right from that to NHL.com. And then a couple of years ago, started talks with The Athletic. And
well, so I want to ask you about that.
That's where it wound up.
Because that becomes, you know, early on, The Athletic is a bit of an experiment, right, in terms of will people pay for sports writing? And there was a thought for a while, and it's still out there, that with so much free content available on the internet at tallcanaudio.com, that people won't...
Quality material available.
Some of it, yeah, sometimes.
Thank you.
So that maybe people won't pay anymore. They're so used to getting it for free. And The Athletic comes along and they decide if we have good writers, we have good work, it's going to be ad-free, but you're going to pay a couple of bucks a month for it. And we really think this is going to work. And it takes off in a couple of markets and it starts to expand. And I'd be really curious to hear how you end up getting involved with them and sort of what your take on that model is in 2020.
It's so at the Sochi Olympics in 2014, I had a friend of mine in Pittsburgh, Dejan Kovacevic, who at that time I ended up talking, you know, we'd go out for beers and everybody's, hey, so how's it going at your place? You know, what's happening?
Talk
a lot of industry talk. Exactly. And he told me at that time he was thinking about leaving to start his own website. So back in Sochi.
Yep.
So I'm like, wow, sounds pretty adventurous. And he's like, yeah, I'm going to, you know, it's going to be a subscription site in Pittsburgh and done a little bit of research. Anyway, so he launches DK on Pittsburgh Sports.
Yeah, I think that ended up working out, did it not? Like, did pretty well from
some. He wound up with 40,000 subscribers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In Pittsburgh.
Unreal.
Just because, he's been a controversial figure at times.
Yeah.
And of course, then The Athletic comes in and they become a direct competitor. And that was a nasty battle. And,
I bet.
But I'll give DK credit because I think he was a little bit ahead of the curve with the idea of this subscription site.
Yeah,
so I actually went down and had a meeting with him just to kind of get an idea of you know his business model because I thought about doing the same thing myself.
Right.
And he started out just doing it by himself. Now I want to say he's got like maybe 15 people working with him now.
Wow.
And I said to him, you know, I said the way I see it, the big advantage you've got here in Pittsburgh is you've got the Penguins.
And the Pirates and the Steelers.
The Pirates.
And
the Steelers, Duquesne University.
Yeah.
Penn State. Like,
mm-hmm.
I mean, what do we got in Ottawa? We got the Senators at that time, you know, maybe a CFL team.
Right.
Yeah.
You know,
or maybe not.
Junior hockey.
Yep.
I said, I just don't know if the volume is there to make it work. And he said that 2/3 of their subscribers were hockey fans.
Yeah.
That he just felt like, for some reason, hockey fans was a younger demographic, which was more open to the idea of, you know, reading on an app.
Well,
and he said Steelers and Pirates fans were more the older generation.
Right.
Predisposed towards like reading a paper
box score.
Product.
Yeah,
maybe going on the internet to read the occasional story.
Yeah.
So I think I think DK was onto something
for
there
sure.
Because as you know, the reason The Athletic has been as successful as it has been in Canada is because of the Leafs coverage. Like the hockey has been
Toronto,
absolutely critical to what The Athletic's been able to achieve, and not just in Toronto, which, you know, it really is the engine that makes the whole thing work is the Leafs. But you look at all the hockey markets in the States where they went in and kind of hired the top beat guy in each of those cities
and they've done it in baseball. You get Ken Rosenthal on board and you get some of the guys.
I think that's the other cool thing about what they did was, you know, particularly here in Canada where, you know, I run into people and they're a Jacksonville Jaguars fan, right, or they're a Steelers, sure, fan, or a 49ers fan. And so, like, who knows what the roots of these,
yeah,
this fandom is. But now you can have access all in one place.
You,
so you can open up and read the Senators in the morning.
Yeah.
And then right after that, you can go over and you've got, you know, probably one of the best beat guys in the business who's covering your NFL team,
right,
or your baseball team or your favorite,
yeah,
college team.
Well, so
and you can fine tune your
you set up your feed to be whatever you want it to be.
And you can have whatever you want coming in there.
Well, when they first, and to me, I remember Pierre LeBrun talking about it when he first signed on, and he was talking about the beauty of it is, and this probably will resonate strongly with you as well, is the ability that The Athletic afforded to write longer, more in-depth, yeah, pieces, right? Not your sort of surface fluff that you're trying, yep, to you're trying to crank out it on, yeah, a time, and you just
and I get that there's, you know, there's all these kind of layers and niches in the business, and you know, the radio guys turn around the audio from the scrums, whether it be a practice day or the coach's, mm-hmm, availability or whatever. You know, the radio guys, if they don't, you know, have the coach on live, are flipping around the scrums from the dressing room really quick, yeah, so you can hear what everybody's saying that day, yeah, and then the papers kind of slip in, and then I think where The Athletic has found a niche is doing kind of like you said, those more like one step back, broader perspective, longer term, longer read.
Yeah, people willing to pay for sports coverage are want to go more in depth. They want to know more,
and I think that's the key. There is, like, it's got to be a little bit more. There's got to be more depth to it.
Yeah.
Well, and I didn't mean to denigrate the print thing when, right, I said fluff, because there is people who
but
are
they're working on basically on a 24-hour clock,
slave to the clock.
You gotta get something out right away. You got to get something out for the website. You got to get something out for the paper. You've got to cobble together something on a game where your deadline is like at 10 to 10.
Yeah.
And there are people who just want to know. They want the surface stuff. They don't really care that much.
Some people are fine with that. Yeah.
And so us, guys who talk about on our spare time, you spend doing this, who want more, right?
Right.
There is the differing sort of clientele.
So my understanding, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong, with the growth of The Athletic, especially in Canada, was this notice, because I believe they launched in Chicago, yeah, San Francisco, maybe, and there was two or three markets they launched in off the, but they were surprised that the demand was so high for hockey. And that doesn't surprise me at all in the United States, where the hockey fan probably does feel like he's coming in all the time behind, yeah, baseball and football, yeah, and whatever.
Local
and,
college team.
Right. Yeah. And so you end up in the NHL and people are digging that. And so they come to Toronto and it takes off in a big way there. I remember, I'm a big James Myrtle guy. I like, yep, his work. So, yep, he signs on there and he's going to run part of that and takes his work there and some of the guys who come in behind him. And it obviously hockey here is king. I'm curious how it starts to expand out. Do you approach them? Do they approach you? How do you end up kind of, you know, jumping in as they start expanding out to the other Canadian NHL markets especially?
Yeah, well, I had worked with Arpin Basu out of Montreal.
Yeah.
He was at NHL.com and also the French counterpart in Montreal. And Arpin was tapped to go and work for The Athletic in Montreal.
Right.
And then at that point, Arpin was like, oh, I should come and work for The Athletic. You know, they're doing great things. I think you're really suited for it. Your type of writing and everything else would be good for us. And I was like, okay, well, like, get somebody to call me. And
sure,
I'm willing to talk about anything. And then over the course of a few months, then finally Arpin said, well, I'm going to get Myrtle to call you. So, yeah, Myrtle called me and, you know, he talked about what he wanted and I talked about what I thought I would like to do. And there was a meshing of ideas there. So that's how it wound up coming about, I think, 3 years ago. I'm not,
yeah,
sure now.
It's just you and James Gordon at first, isn't it, here in Ottawa?
Yeah, Graham Nichols.
Graham Nichols
was contributing.
Yeah.
Graham's still doing some great analytics.
Yeah, he does some cool stuff.
Pieces, mm-hmm, for us. And now Haley's here on a full-time,
yeah, doing the beat thing.
Basis, doing the beat thing. So it's nice to see... you know, Ottawa getting some focus and getting some resources from the Athletic to expand the coverage.
So the last thing on the Athletic for me, I wonder, obviously you've signed on, things are going well. Obviously you believe that this type of model can be successful. Do you ever give a whole lot of thought to the idea that, you know, really the only other big time right now connection between the Senators and the market is, you know, they have their broadcast deal with TSN and TSN Radio.
Yeah.
And there's local papers here that do a nice job as well. But are you, as part of the Athletic, maybe separated a little bit? Do you think you maybe have a little more freedom to be critical than some of the TSN people because of the broadcast deals? Do you ever look at it at all like that? Or, you know,
I think I'm at a point in my life and probably at a point in my career now where I'm going to have my opinions.
Yeah.
I guess if it got to the point where somebody felt like those opinions were too strong or somebody didn't like them and they tapped me on the shoulder and said, don't do that, then that would be fine. But I don't think at this time I'm going to change the way I think about things,
right,
or the way that I express them. If I think ownership of the Senators has, and I think you can go back and look at the stuff that I've written for The Athletic, I think I've probably been one of the most
fairly clear.
How do I put it? Opinionated but always from, I would say always with trying to be from the standpoint of it being fair.
Yep.
And not over the top, and just taking whatever event or comment that might be out there that needed analyzing and some objective analysis. That's probably one of the things that I've always strived for in my career, is to be fair.
Right.
And if anybody wanted to come back at me and say, how could you write this, that I could easily defend whatever it is that I've written.
But
and that I'm not just plucking something out of my ass.
And so I know you do, you know, some work and some on-air stuff with TSN 1200, but do you feel like the fact that you're not, you know, the Athletic doesn't have the same tie to the Senators that maybe the only sports station in town does?
Right.
Do you feel like that maybe gives you a little more freedom? I'm not criticizing anyone at TSN because they're doing a really good job.
Yeah.
But there is a partnership. That station needs the local team, and that local team needs the station.
Yep.
Do you feel like maybe you have a little more freedom, your distance from that, to be able to be that little bit more critical again, if you have to be?
Yeah, it wouldn't. I don't know if I feel like I need to have the distance or whatever.
Right.
I mean,
or is it just the 35 years of
maybe?
I
mean, the way
reputation.
I approach. I mean, I guess I've got an idea of the way that the job should be approached, the way that the job should be done. And like I said, going back to that foundation of fairness,
right?
I would say anybody who, like I said, if there was somebody that disagreed with my opinion, I'd certainly be willing to listen to their side of
it.
But before stating that opinion, you can be pretty sure that I'm going to have the facts or the analysis that I've done to make me have that opinion that will back me up in any kind of argument where somebody would say, well, how could you say this? That's just not true. I would hope that I wouldn't let myself get into that trap. And if they didn't like something that I said, I'd just be like, this is reality.
Sure.
How can you argue otherwise?
There you have it. We had a lot of fun having Chris Stevenson in studio with us. Really appreciate him being so generous with his time. He's had quite a career. You go back and you hear some of those names, guys like Red Fisher when he gets talking about him. Man, he's seen it all in this industry. A couple of Olympic Games, you know, all the hockey in the world you can possibly imagine. It was quite a journey. Really appreciate him being so generous with his time to hang out with us a little bit. You can follow Chris on Twitter at @CJ_Stevenson, or, you know, just hit us up at @TallCanAudio on Twitter. We're always retweeting and, you know, we'll have his handle there. You can also, of course, find his work at The Athletic Ottawa, or just theathletic.com, or on your app if you're subscribed already. It is a subscription model, so you will have to get yourself a subscription to be able to read his stuff there, but certainly well worth your time, I think. And of course, the Ottawa Craft Beer Insider on YouTube or on your favorite podcast app. Lots of places you'll be able to hear Chris Stevenson and what he's going on, and hopefully he'll come back and do this again sometime. I really hope you enjoyed the show. This was a cool get for us, and we were really glad that that we were able to make this happen and have such an in-depth conversation with a guy who has, you know, been around for this long and seen this much in this industry, and for him to make a little time with us to come have a couple of beers and just talk, you know, about his journey. It's always a lot of fun. I suppose that's where we'll wrap this one up. My name's Matt Robinson. You can, of course, find us on Twitter and Instagram. We are at Tall Can Audio. We are on Facebook at facebook.com/tallcanaudio. The archives, all that kind of stuff, always at tallcanaudio.com. We'll get out of here, and we'll catch you on the next one.
Stop the hammering. Stop the hammering. Jesus Christ. Crazy fucking sound coming in my ear. It just fucking sucks. It fucking sucks.
Thanks for listening. You can get more TCA at tallcanaudio.com or by searching Tall Can Audio on your favorite podcast app.
Fucking out of control shit.